Hello, everyone, and welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. My name is Paul Taylor, and I am the president of Evolving Wisdom, one of the organizations producing the event. Tonight, a remarkable cultural phenomenon will continue to unfold. We once again thank everyone for their patience with our technical difficulties, and but it's definitely worth the wait. I myself have personally been incredibly inspired and educated by the first three calls in this series, especially seeing the upswelling of awareness and passion unleashed by this conversation that Terry has convened here. We are obviously at a very significant juncture in the evolution of human awareness. This call today will be a part of that unfolding. It's all of our intention that it moves the conversation forward so that we can all participate more fully in the evolution of culture and consciousness. The interest in this teleseries just continues to get stronger. Many of you have asked us some technical questions and have asked us how you can connect with each other personally to explore the ideas and inspirations that are arising out of the series. The first place I want to point you to is our blog at beyondawakeningseries.com/blog. This is where many of you have already come and introduced yourself. You'll find the schedule for the next few weeks and links where you can download the dialogues that have already taken place. You'll also be able to meet some of the other people who are part of our community and hear a little about their lives and the issues and questions that they're interested in. The conversation that began there will soon be migrating to a brand new community site that will be a much richer, more flexible, and thoroughly engaging home for online discussions and networking. I'll be announcing more about that when it's live, so everyone can visit and dive into it then. The other way to engage is by joining our Facebook group. There you can find links and announcements and meet other people who share an interest in the evolution of spirituality and engage in ongoing discussions about all the topics we'll be exploring here in this series. So just click on the Facebook link in the email we sent you today or go to beyondawakeningseries.com/Facebook. Before we begin, I'd like to introduce you to Integral Spiritual Practice founder, Terry Patton, who is the host and visionary behind this groundbreaking series. Terry Patton is a vital leading voice in the fields of integral evolutionary practice, leadership, and spirituality. He speaks and consults internationally, inspiring, challenging, and connecting integral evolutionary leaders and institutions worldwide. A gifted communicator, community builder, successful entrepreneur, educator, and author of four books, Terry has worked for over three decades as a philosopher, an activist, a coach, a teacher, helping leaders embody higher consciousness in practical actions that transform complex systems. He is the author with Ken Wilber of Integral Life Practice, and his personal website is integralspiritualpractice.com. Welcome, Terry.
Well, thank you, Paul, and hello, everybody. Thank you for hanging in there during our technical difficulties just now. But thank you to Brad and the other members of the wonderful team that's worked together and sweated together over this last half hour to create this event. And I want to say a thank you to the generous sponsors who are the reason that it's possible for us to offer this to everyone absolutely free. And especially I want to thank those of you who are listening, not just for hanging in through the technical difficulties, but for your sincere interest in the subjects we're discussing, for showing up with sincerity and authenticity and seriousness. You know, that's what makes this inquiry so profound and powerful. The one thing that has been a little strange at times for me has been that even though I know I'm talking to thousands of people, I really have only gotten to hear the voices of a few. So I have persuaded our audio engineer, Brad, to reluctantly agree to let me open up the mics at the end of our broadcast so we can all say goodbye and say thank you to one another and hear each other's voices. So I'm looking forward to that. We'll do that at the end of the call. So the title here, Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice, is meant to cue us all into a conversation about a new emerging evolutionary spirituality and how it can help us rise to the challenges of our time, which are quite intense. It's my honor tonight to be hosting one of the powerhouse voices in the world of evolutionary spirituality, spiritual teacher Andrew Cohen, in a conversation about the practice of evolution. This seminar series has convened a conversation about how our spirituality can create a cultural context so that we can embody a new kind of leadership and even heroism and in order to make a transition to a sustainable human presence on this planet. Many of us were originally inspired to embrace spiritual life by the insight summarized in the line that's almost become a cliche at this point, but it's a very true statement. We cannot solve our problems with the same kind of consciousness that created them. We haven't necessarily seen, not in an unambiguous and clear way, how the higher consciousness delivered by contemporary spirituality can really pay off that promise. Does it help some of the most sensitive and intelligent among us to just go inward instead of outward, instead of leaning in to help change human culture and society so that we can really adapt and meet our pressing crises? In the series introduction, I talked about how human knowledge is beginning to sketch out for those thinkers who are truly generalists, who are really putting all the puzzle pieces together in a great evolutionary synthesis, which truly changes everything. We are heading somewhere. And taken together with our current world crises, it really recontextualizes our spirituality. In the second call, Ken Wilber offered us a look at the stages of human development, the quadrants, and the states, higher states of consciousness, and how we may be at the dawning of a new integral age. In our last dialogue, Michael Murphy asserted that although a new coherent evolutionary and incarnational spirituality and spiritual view is emerging, a philosophical evolutionary panentheism, it's only meandering rather than taking charge. It's still at the margins of influence. And he suggested that what may really be transforming our culture more rapidly right now is the actual practices of yoga, meditation, and martial arts that have become mainstream in towns from Topeka to Salinas. Now, today we're going to hear from a man who's truly on fire with a transcendent passion to serve the evolution of consciousness and culture. Andrew Cohen's most original contribution is his spiritual teaching, Evolutionary Enlightenment. He himself originally awakened in the tradition of Advaita Vedanta in the lineage of Ramana Maharshi. But from the beginning, he was original and intense and iconoclastic and even controversial. He's the author of 7 books, including Enlightenment is a Secret and Living Enlightenment. And he's currently writing a new book on evolutionary enlightenment. For more information, you can visit www.andrewcohen.com. His spiritual teachings have continually evolved and changed for 24 years in a unique trajectory, going from impersonal enlightenment to evolutionary enlightenment. At this point, he finds more in common with Sri Aurobindo and Teilhard de Chardin than he does with Ramana Maharshi, really. Those two streams of thought inform his work, but he's not just synthesized them, he's added an original element, which is a really original and nuanced perspective on the practical dynamics of individual transformation, but also cultural transformation. He's really focused on collective awakening, intersubjective spiritual potentials, and new ways of living and working together. One of the most interesting things that's happened is that he's really worked it intensely with a small group of close students, a living laboratory of evolution at Enlighten Next, and they've been creating experimental prototypes for a new cultural paradigm. And in addition to his work as a spiritual teacher, he's been dedicated now for 18 years to changing the larger cultural conversation, something that most of us have encountered through his flagship publication, Enlighten Next magazine, formerly What is Enlightenment? And it's really one of the best forums we have, one of the best catalysts for serious discussions at the leading edge of spirituality and culture. He also speaks all over the world in numerous forums, including the Parliament of the World's Religions and universities, spiritual centers, and even business settings all around the globe. And his organization has centers worldwide and members in over 20 countries. More personally, one of the things that I've come to deeply appreciate about Andrew Cohen is that he is obviously and authentically on fire with a sense of inspired purpose and urgency. Spiritual teachers have always traditionally spoken with a prophetic voice, and he does so very powerfully. That's compelling in itself, but what's even better is that Andrew has been willing to mix it up. He's not just unafraid to offend others. In fact, he's sometimes been known for that. But in our conversations, I've found him to be really available. He's welcomed my challenging questions. He's shown himself to be not just open to continuing to evolve, but committed to it. And we got to know each other best in the context of some very spirited debates. So he offers not just inspiring vision and compelling passion, but also the willingness to get down. Now, spiritual teachers traditionally represent kind of a criticism of the what's sometimes called the consensus trance in ordinary society, the slumber. And it's been said, really, even thousands of years ago, spiritual teachers have said, everything must change. Well, here is someone who not only says such words, but he is definitely not kidding when he says them. So welcome, Andrew. I'm delighted to have you on our program.
Well, Terry, thank you for such a wonderful introduction.
Well, thank you for being here, and thank you for enduring our delay. To orient our call, Andrew, you know, we've been having what's begun to be a pretty serious conversation about this moment in our evolution as a time that requires a new level of inspiration that needs to have its roots in a new spiritual vision. And I know that you, although you found your awakening in the tradition of Advaita Vedanta, and it was radically liberating, after a few years, you didn't find it a sufficient context for your work, and you really felt an evolutionary approach was necessary for you to really authentically be the teacher you are. So can you offer us a quick summary overview of why a new evolutionary spirituality is so necessary now?
Well, I think that the traditional Eastern model really represents the ultimate spiritual position being one that's really about transcendence. You know, transcendence of the mind, transcendence of the body, transcendence of the world, transcendence of time. It's really about experiencing a state of consciousness where we experience a freedom from embodiedness and from being trapped within any kind of fixed structures. But it's really the traditional enlightenment, at least I understand, you know, to speak in very general terms, is really about discovering the profound experience of freedom from. And from the very beginning of my teaching career, you know, 24 years ago, I don't know really what the reason was, but I wanted to know how the experience of being free from, completely and unconditionally and radically free from, all of manifestation, all of embodiment, and being free from mind in all of its shapes and forms, how that actually would translate. How it actually translated into the actual human experience of embodiedness, of being in a body and of being engaged with a very active mind that helps us to really interpret our experience. How did it help to make sense of our relationships? How did it help us to really interpret our experience in a way that would make profound sense of life? So from the very beginning, that was really the question I was solving, and I found really that most people who came to me, even though they would have very profound experiences of transcendence, the translation of those experiences into a greater source of confidence in how we make meaning, and also how to actually engage, you know, within the human experience. Was that translation, most people just simply didn't know how to make it. So I really dedicated myself really early on how to translate the traditional and perennial experience of non-duality, the awakening to primordial enlightened awareness, Translating that into how is that going to help us make meaning out of the human experience? Because it occurred to me very early on that we seem to be built for action. We seem to, the human body, the human form, the human mind is really created for engagement. We're actually here to be involved with the process that created us. It became apparent to me, over the years, that within this context, that the traditional model of enlightenment being quote unquote fully enlightened would be that all of one's karmas had finally been burned, and therefore one was liberated from the chain of cause and effect, from the reincarnational cycle, and that ultimately the fully liberated one would never have to return back to Earth, into human form, and would achieve an ultimate and final liberation. But when we when I discovered really over a certain period of time the evolutionary worldview, which gave a picture about how we've been created, that made that picture of spiritual enlightenment not really make any sense anymore, because the universe came into being a little less than 14 billion years ago. The Earth came into being about 5 billion years ago. Life itself was born around 3 billion years ago. Human culture only started between 250,000 years ago, and we can see that the capacity for human consciousness and cognition, which was born with human civilization, has gone through extraordinary developmental and evolutionary leaps over that 250,000 or 200,000 year period. And from a certain point of view, we realize that from the perspective of evolution, which is the movement from the first cause, from energy to light to matter to consciousness to self-reflective awareness, it becomes apparent to us that the process that began with a big explosion 14 billion years ago really is only beginning to awaken to itself, is beginning to gain the capacity to cognize itself, to recognize itself, to realize itself, to know itself, to behold itself through our own awakening to our own primordial origins, and through this extraordinary capacity for self-reflection to begin to meditate and to deeply consider and recognize, who we are, how we are, to see all of the experience we're having in the present moment, our capacity for consciousness and cognition, within the context of this really deep time process. When we really begin to see that the process is really just beginning to awaken to itself through us, then the idea that becoming a fully spiritually enlightened human being meant that we would never have to return here didn't make any sense to me anymore. It seemed like an outdated perspective that came into being at a time when the evolutionary process wasn't going to be discovered for thousands of years. So when we realize that the process that created us is barely just now, almost yesterday more or less, is beginning to awaken to itself, that it's just getting started, in that light we would have to then begin to recontextualize and reconsider what our ideas are about what it means to spiritually evolve, what it means to become a spiritually enlightened human being. And as I think we really begin to learn more and more about how we have become who we are now, how the universe has created ourselves and all the capacities we have that makes us human beings over through a very long deep developmental process, we realize that it seems to be that the point really and the point spiritually, the point is actually to find a way to be more here than we ever have been, to really get involved in the process, to kind of ultimately to take responsibility for it. But before we can take responsibility for it, we have to really find a way to engage infinitely more deeply with who we always have been, but simply haven't really been in a position to be able to do it yet. So, the new evolutionary enlightenment, or the new enlightenment, is really about becoming more interested in the becoming, in evolutionary becoming, and what in that leap that took place when the Big Bang happened, in that leap that forth from being to becoming, from nothing to something, from formlessness to form. I think the new enlightenment, the new spirituality, is really about becoming very interested and engaged with, and ultimately spiritually committed to the process that gave rise to all of our human capacities, and then ultimately through that, becoming interested in taking responsibility for where it's all going. Because when we realize that it's actually a process, that we are all part of a process that's actually going somewhere, that's in progress, we also begin to realize that where the process is going, especially at the highest levels, is ultimately dependent upon the choices that we human beings make. And so when we realize that, this begins to really sacralize or make sacred, the human experience, because we realize that our relationship to the experience of being a human being, and the choices and the measure of freedom that we all have to choose, is ultimately going to be determining, the trajectory of our collective future. And so then what it means to be a human being, becomes a very serious and profound matter. Being who we are, having the privilege of the experience of embodiment, and having the gift of self-reflective awareness at this particular time, especially for those of us who are fortunate enough to have been born in relatively fortunate circumstances and have had the gift of education and high levels of cultural development, we realize that we are among the luckiest people that have ever been born, and we have a capacity to grasp and cognize, what it actually means to be who we are, and take responsibility for where we're going in ways that human beings most likely never have had in all the ways that we do now. And so this is really the awakening to, the glory and the majesty, the miracle of what it means to be ourselves, And as we do that, as I was saying, a minute ago, we awaken to, a profound and humbling sense of responsibility, of purposefulness, meaningfulness in the gift of life and in the gift of consciousness. And so what this awakens is in us is not only a great sense of humility, but a great sense of seriousness about what it means to be alive, and then we begin to take seriously then the power inherent in our own capacity to make choices, to actually affect the process for the better, because ultimately we realize that the best thing we can possibly do with the gift of life, is to in a small but not insignificant way, make the process better, make the process that we all are better because of the choices that we've made. And I believe that the spiritual life right now, especially the sincere spiritual life, is really all about taking responsibility for where we're all going.
Which is transition then to evolving consciously, as Barbara Mark Subbard likes to, that phrase, conscious evolution, that since we know we're evolving for the first time, and since we are reaching certain important limits to the numbers of people and the resources that we're using up, that we have both the opportunity for the first time and the necessity for the first time to evolve intentionally, which has never happened before.
That's true. There was one comment I wanted to make when I was listening to your introduction. There was the kind of a distinction I just wanted to put on the table that I think is important for all conversations like this, because often when we hear people talking about you know, awakening to this, to evolution and to the evolutionary impulse and to the potential inherent in that. It's almost always done and spoken about in light of the fact that we are facing a global crisis, a crisis of survival that is urgent and that is serious and that's life-threatening and that needs to be responded to and taken responsibility for. And I think it's important to make the point that at least it's become clear to me that I don't actually think the urge to evolve, the aspiration to evolve, or awakening to the spiritual inspiration to evolve, is necessarily the same impulse as the impulse to survive. In other words, we are threatened with a crisis for survival, but from a certain point of view, we can say, well, we have been threatened with many different kinds and forms of crises since way before we ever stood up on two legs. And we have found ways to survive. We're very good at surviving and being faced with the threat of extinction in many different ways and forms. You know, whether it's the threat of a natural disaster, or because our enemies were going to wipe out our tribe, or whatever the cause happened to be. That as evolving sentient life forms, we've been faced with the threat of survival and imminent doom and destruction forever. And I think the impulse to want to find a way to survive any particular imminent crisis, including the one we're facing, is a perennial, we could say, almost instinct. But the instinct to, as Barbara Marx Hubbard would say, to consciously evolve, to which is a particularly uniquely spiritual aspiration and inspiration. You know, the desire the inspiration to rise to a higher level of consciousness and cognition, and a greater capacity for interiority. I think actually is a different kind of impulse that is newly emergent or emerging, that that is definitely not synonymous with any particular imminent threat, because the evolutionary impulse, you know, as I understand it, you know, is a continuous compulsion towards higher and greater potentials that is relentless, and no matter what the external circumstances are going to be, its aspiration is always going to be striving towards realizing and manifesting and releasing potentials that have not been realized or released yet, no matter what the external circumstances to be. Of course, a situation, a collective situation where we're threatened with, you know, imminent danger, you know, tells us, well, we're going to have to come up with better ways of doing things, because the old ways of thinking have got us into the mess that we're in right now. And of course, in order to do that, all kinds of evolution at many different levels, you know, of individual and cultural and technological and many other ways are obviously essential for that to happen. But I just wanted to make the point that I think we should be careful to too easily speak about the survival threat we're facing and the fact that that in this new spirituality or this new impulse to evolve are co-arising, or seem to be.
I love this point. I'm glad you brought it up. I think it's pretty essential, and that is that this sense of urgency is inherent in the awakening that you're talking about. It's inherent in my spirituality, which, you know, I'm not your student. I arrived at this in my own way. I think there's something inherent about it. But I do find it actually inspiring and even beautiful that this new view and understanding and inspiration would become possible for human beings right at a time when a series of in, in, intentional cultural choices, intentional in a whole new way and on a whole new scale, are also necessary. To me, there's a beauty in that synchronicity, and it's a sign of something. It's not something we have to delete from the picture in order to understand the purity of our impulse, although the impulse is not fear-based and it's not compensatory.
Right.
It's still true somehow that how beautiful that we not only can but have to.
Well, the thing is that the have to is a different kind of motive, because, for example, when I often would speak to people about this, I try to make this point in this way, saying that, well, let's say we could wave a magic wand and global warming wouldn't be a problem. Let's say we could wave a magic wand and overpopulation wouldn't be a problem. Let's say we could wave a magic wand and the majority of the unbearable poverty that exists in the third world would be a problem. I said we would still be faced, those of us at higher levels of development, who have been blessed with relative wealth and unprecedented of freedoms, of movement and of thought, historically speaking. We'd still be more or less in the same cultural predicament that we're in right now, even if we didn't have to solve some of these larger problems.
You mean postmodern consciousness is at a dead end in a way, and modernism is at a dead end? Cultural collisions.
Modern consciousness, of course, is upholding a position and a worldview that is definitely no longer appropriate, to meet the realities of the world we're living in, in just about every way, and postmodern consciousness, in the same way, has definitely come to a dead end. So culturally, at the level of the individual and at the level of our shared intersubjective reality and world, that we create together, there is a crisis. We're facing a cultural crisis. There's an existential crisis. There's a crisis of our collective soul, and assuming that these larger survival issues, just suddenly would be able to, someone may wave the magic wand and they disappeared, we'd be in exactly the same mess. And sometimes I think that it's important to say that, because I think many people feel, well, if we find a way to deal with, with global warming and the degradation of the environment and overpopulation, everything's going to be okay. And I think the relationship to our survival would no longer be threatened in the same way. But in terms of the cultural predicament that we're in, really wouldn't be affected at all. And so it's important to make this distinction, because our internal cultural evolution, the world of our shared values, the way we actually make meaning and make purpose, our shared agreements, really need to be questioned and scrutinized. And I think a very big part of spiritual practice right now for people who are very serious has to do with really beginning to put on the table, all of our shared agreements in terms of how we make meaning, what are our shared values, many of them are conscious and many more unconscious, and really begin to, I think, collectively begin to deconstruct a lot of really, traditional, modern, and postmodern values that we still may be operating out of that we're not even fully conscious of. But in other words, we really, at this point, if we're interested in conscious evolution, have to begin to create and discover together new ways to make meaning and sense and purpose out of life. And I think that's very urgent, because most young adults and not so young adults, are existentially and understandably quite confused as to how human life is actually supposed to be lived at this point, and how it is that we're supposed to make meaning, even in the world of human relationship, and relatedness, what's the role, function, and purpose of the traditional relationships that culture has been made up of, and a lot of this is really up for question. So I think this is really very urgent. And of course, you know, bringing it back to the topic, of course, when we awaken to the fact that we're part of a deep time developmental process that's going somewhere, evolution means we're part of a process that's going somewhere, and where we're ultimately going now depends upon the choices that we make. You know, it becomes apparent to us that we, you know, and I like the word you used, but we are the ones that have to become the spiritual heroes. They're going to be willing, in all our imperfection, to be the ones that are going to at least make the effort to define, you know, what these new values are actually going to be and what they're going to look like. Because we have to get moving, because the old structures don't work anymore. And I've noticed that a lot of people, because they haven't found new ways to make meaning, they often just because new values and new structures haven't quite emerged yet, many people are just trying to do things in the old way in order to derive and discover a sense of security and comfort and a sense of safety, you know, in a chaotic and insecure world space. And we can't go back, because there is nowhere to go back to anymore. We have to go forward, and we have to together find a way to make meaning and values and new shared perspectives and shared agreements that really are able to, you know, embrace the reality of the fast-paced changing intersubjective world space that we're living, that we're all sharing together. And embracing our own, you know, the liberated nature of our own spiritual essence as, you know, what I call the evolutionary impulse, because the energy and intelligence that initiated the creative process and is driving the creative process, you know, the God impulse, the evolutionary impulse, are, you know, the source of our evolutionary inspiration is the new definition of what spirit or God actually is. And when we awaken to that dimension of ourself, we awaken to a fearless inspiration to, you know, to roll up our sleeves and to get really involved, you know, in the chaos that we're in, the chaos of the world and of the process that we're in, and we live in the thrill and in the excitement of trying to take the next step. We find our own salvation, our own liberation, our own enlightenment, and our own freedom in actually taking responsibility for the chaos and endeavoring to make meaning. And not through any kind of withdrawal, but for actually getting in there and saying, no, I'm the one that's going to do it. It really is up to me, because from an ultimate or absolute or non-relative or mystical point of view, you know, there is only one and not two anyway. There ultimately is only one. And from the deepest non-dual perspective, each and every one of us is that one without a second. From the perspective of that deepest part of ourself, we are the only one that could possibly make all the difference. And so when we endeavor to take responsibility and embrace the non-dual truth of the fact of who we really are as the creative impulse, revolutionary impulse, we find our own liberation. And then within the complexity, the challenge and the overwhelming complexity of the moment that we're in, through not resisting it but engaging with it wholeheartedly and passionately and unselfconsciously, we find our own liberation in endeavoring to embrace what that next step is. Instead of trying to protect ourselves or to protect old structures, conscious and unconscious, we're not trying to hold on and protect anything because it has been that way in the past anymore. We're not. It doesn't mean we're throwing everything out either, because of course we're all, you know, history has created the selves that we are now and the capacities that we have, but we're no longer fearfully holding on to anything. And it's through that, the fearlessness, which is the nature of the evolutionary impulse, we win our own liberation in the midst of taking responsibility for change. And that's what's so exciting to me.
Well, that's totally exciting to me too. And yet, I want to push into it a little bit further, because I've, on a number of occasions, had conversations with people who have responded, man, all this urgency, you know, it just feels like the agitation that I kind of have been feeling delivered from by my spirituality. Isn't my spirituality about finding a kind of transcendental peace and freedom?
I don't think so. No, I really don't think so. I think that is a very outdated interpretation of what spirit is, because the times have changed. The the where we all have come from, you know, the primordial, timeless, formless ground of all being, that empty no place, that zero point from which the entire manifest realm emerged from, is and has been the spiritual and mystical source for the experience of primordial peace and freedom. So, you know, so in you know, all the great traditions have their mystical schools, and you know, and to speak in broad generalities, you know, most forms of serious and profound mysticism really point us back to zero, to that no place from whence everything that exists came. And so, for example, to put it in contemporary terms, you know, if we enter into a very deep state of meditation, when we transcend the mind, we transcend time. When we transcend time, we transcend the world. And when we transcend time and the world, we transcend form. And when we transcend mind, time, world, and form, everything disappears. And when everything disappears, we realize that that in spite of the fact that everything has disappeared, we're still there. But the self that we are now is formless and has no individual or personal identity whatsoever. And that's the source of primordial and unconditional freedom. And the experience of it's the experience of infinite peace, because nothing has happened yet. You know, the experience of deep and profound meditation is going back to before the beginning. Before anything ever happened, we didn't have any problems to overcome or to escape from, because the universe hadn't been created yet. So before the universe was born, before the universe was created, everything was always perfect because nothing had happened yet. So this is really the traditional position of transcendence, and to put this in an evolutionary context, I think it's fair to say that we all, you know, before we entered into the creative process, we all were abiding for countless billions of eons of no time in a state of infinite peace and quietude and beatitude. So we all have already been abiding in infinite peacefulness and untroubledness and unfetteredness for eternity. So it's something we've already been doing forever. So from an evolutionary point of view, we've already done that for countless eternities. And the point is that from the perspective of evolution, we realize, well, the creative process, you know, when something came from nothing, the Big Bang, the first cause, was a big explosion. It wasn't peaceful, and the creative process is not peaceful. It's an urgent, ecstatic, explosive event at the level of matter. You know, if we look at how stars are born and how the universe was created, it was when stars collided into each other, the more complex compounds were created that ultimately gave rise to the conditions that made it possible for life to emerge. And at all levels, from matter to life to consciousness, the creative dimension of spirit, you know, the creative dimension of eros or speed of, you know, or eros or spirit, is not peaceful. It's an ecstatic and urgent process that is full of dynamic and creative friction, and that's the nature of what it is. And I think ceasing to resist the creative friction and be willing to get more surrender oneself more consciously to it, and then beginning to take responsibility for where it's all going. And ultimately, and I think the goal is to learn how to actually guide the process through awakening to one's own higher will, becomes the ultimate form of ecstasy and freedom and personal self-liberation. In other words,
but doesn't it rest in a way? I mean, my experience is it's a little like the pre-trans fallacy in integral theory, that there was a kind of anxious, egoic urgency that I might feel very often in my life prior to a certain liberation that I experienced, in which I really got a bigger context and I contacted a peace that, as they say, passeth all understanding. And it was really only on the basis of contacting that fundamental relaxation of stress and recontextualizing where I stood altogether, that a whole different kind of urgency came alive for me, this evolutionary urgency. And that therefore it's not, you know, we might even use the same words for it, but it isn't of the same nature as the kind of egoic urgency that's so common.
Well, I'm not talking about egoic urgency. I'm certainly not talking about egoic urgency. I'm talking about evolutionary urgency, the ecstatic urgency of the evolutionary impulse. And that waits for no one. So the ego within the individual, the ego within the individual always needs more time. It needs more time, needs a vacation, needs to experience peace in order to be ready to get ready for the main event. But from a God's eye point of view, which is actually very different than the ego's perspective, that part of you and that part of me doesn't need a vacation, doesn't need to experience the fullness and the bliss of peace before it's ready to get in the ring. It's always fully prepared, fully ready for prime time, without hesitation, without fear, without doubt. It's always ready to go. Now, that's the Creator God. That's God as Eros, or as the evolutionary impulse. Its spirit as the evolutionary impulse is always ready now. So once again the ego, or the unenlightened part of the self, feels threatened and burdened by such a total level of responsibility, which leaves no room for itself. It feels like, well, I'm going to die. You know, if I have to get that involved with the creative process, you know, even if it is an ecstatic engagement, I think that I am going to die because I won't be able to take it. But just as in the tradition, what I call the traditional enlightenment, the fears and desires of the ego had to be transcendent in order to be able to let go of the mind and let go of the world in order to experience that primordial peace, or as you clearly described, the peace that passeth all understanding. In the same way, you know, with the new evolutionary enlightenment, in order to awaken to and become one with the impulse to evolve, you know, with the relentless drive of Eros, we also have to be willing to transcend the fears and desires in exactly the same way. But when we do, we realize that the part of ourself that is convinced that it needs to experience peace before it can let go, and peace before it needs to be ready, is actually just the ego, because the part of ourself that is the evolutionary impulse is already liberated in every single moment and doesn't need time to get ready to be ready, because it's always ready. So when we're able to let go in that way, we find ourselves riding on what I call the wings of the authentic self, and we find ourselves acting and responding with a kind of clarity and a kind of freedom, unselfconscious freedom, unpremeditated unselfconscious freedom.
Right, which is, that, in a way, resting in a peace, isn't it? I mean, there is a peace inherent in that urgency.
Freedom, there's freedom. It's not necessarily peaceful, but it's free.
Happy. It's happy. The kind of conventional stress.
It's free. It's free and happy. No, exactly. It's free from existential fear. It's free from the world of the ego. Absolutely. So it's free from existential stress for sure, but it's definitely not peaceful.
Well, I'll definitely agree
it's
with
definitely
that.
Not peaceful.
I mean, for me, the more I rest, the deeper my meditative peace becomes, the more conformed I feel to a greater will than my own, and the more aligned and ecstatic I feel, and the ways in which that anchors me in a free position that's really completely spaciously beyond the petty concerns that otherwise were impinging, has something in common with the traditional enlightenment. The profound depth is there, and there is the relief of the ordinary stress of the self-contraction.
There's no question about that, and you're absolutely right. But that's absolutely true. But looking at spiritual development within an evolutionary context, at least it's my conviction, you know, at this particular point in my own development, and as you know, and as I appreciate you saying, I continue to be a work in progress, but it's my conviction that that ultimately we want to get to that place where we don't need to withdraw. It's not that we don't delight in withdrawing into the ground of being. It's not that we don't experience eternal, infinite rapture and delight every single time and discover the ever new, you know, Sat Chit Ananda, you know, being consciousness bliss. That's not our greatest treasure.
Which grants incredible sanity compared to the condition that lacks that.
It does, but I think within the context of evolutionary spirituality, at least as I teach it, the goal would be to get to that point where we don't need to withdraw any longer because we have surrendered so deeply to the process that we already know at the deepest level of our being that everything's all right, which is what we discover when we awaken to the infinite ground of all being. We already know before thought that everything's already okay, and we are so surrendered to the creative process and to what it means to take responsibility for it that we're always ready and that we don't need to take. It means that we don't need to take time out to be ready anymore. I'm just saying the time.
Right,
and
in a way,
removed.
We're so okay that we're never satisfied.
Well, that means we're never satisfied because as the creative impulse is always only focused on the possible, never what has already occurred. So from the perspective of the evolutionary impulse, or the urge towards emergence, or the urge to give rise to that which is new, there is a relentless dissatisfaction with the way things are.
Andrew, I want to move us along to some. I think that these places where we get into the controversies are often the most interesting and juicy parts of our conversations. And one thing that surfaced in the midst of this that it's part of what I said in my introduction, and I certainly feel it, you know, from you as I always do, is the fierceness and passion and urgency that, you know, is you in so many ways. And there are those who say that a kind of uncompromising ferocity is dangerous. It brings people to a place of self-violence. Or one part of them holds an ideal, and that you've got to be a certain way. And then any part of themselves that doesn't seem to be conforming to that ideal is sort of anathematized, and they become split and distanced from part of themselves and damaged. And that you've got the superego kind of bashing the heads of the other parts of the self and undermines people's confidence and self-trust. This kind of ferocity has to be made more gentle. What would you say to that critique?
I would say that they're completely right, except people like that probably weren't prepared, you know, for the kind of journey that I'm talking about. I mean, the way that I teach is based upon recognizing the necessity to become interested in going all the way, whatever that's going to mean. Because you see, when an individual wants to go all the way to the other side, and that's what happened in my own life, you know, when I was a seeker, I got to the point when I came to the point, you know, in my own life as a human being, that it became clear to me that I had to get all the way to the other side. Of course, I didn't know what it meant, but I just knew I wanted to go all the way, whatever it was going to mean. In other words, that means some kind of irrevocable shift. That was way too much, and the point is that it's only, I believe, that kind of awakening to that kind of wholehearted, radical, you know, intention is what awakens awakens and gives rise to a certain kind of spiritual momentum within the self and within groups of selves. That give rise to possibilities and potentials that otherwise are not going to come to the surface. They won't arise or enter into manifestation because an individual simply is not ready for that kind of wholehearted, you know, radical embrace and identification with spirit, and that's perfectly fine. But I mean,
so that in a way there might be legitimate spiritual work that is, you know, kind of getting ready for more radical spiritual work, and you're specializing in the more radical work. Is that a takeaway from what you just said? Is that an implication?
No, not at all. Not at all. I'm interested in doing whatever I can in my own small but hopefully not insignificant way to catalyze a cultural revolution at the leading edge, and I'm deadly serious about it, and I really mean business. It's what I'm living for. It's not a game to me. It's in other words, Terry, for example, when a group of individuals, when a shared culture is threatened, you know, would become threatened for some reason by another culture, and the other culture wants to attack them and wants to threaten their very survival. You know, human beings go to war. You know, this has been happening, you know, throughout human history. The level of urgency that human beings awaken to when their very survival is being threatened, you know, is quite something. And so what has become apparent to me is that if only human beings could feel as urgent and as empowered and as committed to conscious evolution and to giving rise to new emergent potentials as they do when their way of life is being threatened by the evil others. Because it seems that we can only really arouse human beings to that level of commitment and passion in relationship to the need to survive. And what I'm working for is to awaken people to that same level of passion in relationship to the urgency urgency for conscious evolution. And remember, we're speaking about this potential now in relationship to conscious evolution, in relationship to our shared culture. So what I'm teaching and what I'm speaking about is really not about the merely about the liberation of the individual, but about creating a living context in which individuals can actually give rise to new and higher potentials that have great significance for everybody, you know, so that we're, you know, that our
right.
spiritual
so,
life
so
becomes...
So this is calling for a kind of heroism that involves an extraordinary focus and capacity, and some people might not be ready for that. And
A lot of people are ready for it.
So the people who aren't ready, but since something larger needs to happen and you're calling for that, those who are not ready for it, is there a honorable way for them to be related, for some of this call to resonate for them and for them to have part of their being that responds,
well,
for them to participate in a less than radical
of course,
and total
well, of course,
passionate
of,
way?
Of course there is. I mean, the first thing that came to my mind, you know, when you just said that was, for, you know, to use look in the Eastern model, for example, in the Buddhist, you know, in traditional Buddhism, the abandoning the world and becoming a bhikkhu or becoming a monk was seen as the highest form of commitment to the spiritual life. And of course, there were many. Some people felt that calling and rose to it, you know, and often made great sacrifices to do it, often at the expense of other people. And many other people felt, well, this is way beyond what I feel capable of doing. But I recognize the majesty and the cultural and higher significance of the spiritual sacrifices and commitment of these men and women who have taken this step so they can really give their life to spirit. And I realize like that their victory, that supporting their victory is really supporting the evolution of spirit. And so many Buddhists then would in many different ways support the great sacrifices of this very serious spiritual life, for example, that the monks and bhikkhunis or nuns were living. And as a result, at least within the tradition, you know, of course, they would win merit by supporting the efforts of these individuals who are willing to make a greater sacrifice. So of course, by supporting individuals who are going to make sacrifices from which we're all going to benefit, you know, is one very important way to win merit. And also it brings the whole notion, which is a challenging one in our context, of the hierarchy of value in relationship to the spiritual endeavor, which is, I know, not a very popular topic. But there are many different ways to approach all this, and I think that if we're sincere about evolving and developing, then whatever we're doing is going to be valid as long as we're actually sincere about it. But as we look more closely, as we begin to focus our lens as to what catalyzes actual evolution and what really becomes just a form of of not really making much progress. Because, you know, the way I think of it, Terry, is I you know, this is just a really a broad spectrum of view. I basically say I give people broadly about 30 years to do whatever they want, because I feel that it would take you know, a reasonably mature person around 30 years of a human experience to be expected to no longer live a life of foolishness or ignorance. You know, I feel it's very difficult to blame a 22-year-old kid for behaving in an ignorant and foolish way, because they're just a kid. They don't really know what they're doing. But by the time somebody's 30 years old, they'd have 30 years of real lived human experience. I think we could reasonably expect, assuming the person is not emotionally or psychologically or some other way, you know, severely damaged or impaired, that they've lived long enough to be able to begin to draw some deep conclusions about what this is really all about. And so then the question is, after we reach the 30-year mark, when we go from 30 to 35 to 40, 40 to 45 to 50 to 60, you know, and beyond that question, what are we, you know, how much are we actually developing? How much will we actually learn from the real lived life experience that we have had? And how far have we actually come? And so what I encourage people to do is to be willing to be rather clear, you know, to make the effort to be clear about how seriously they're taking their own capacity to evolve or not. And people who actually are evolving and developing, you can start to see over a period of 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, you can see the individual really is changed. They've changed. They're continuing to change. They are evolving, and they are continuing to become a more evolved human being. And if that's the case, all is good. But that often is not the case.
But one of the things that is important to me is, you know, I can see that if we're really going to transform human culture, we need, you know, as it were, awakened and responsible and participatory people at every possible level, across the spiral, across the spectrum, butchers, bakers, candlestick makers, janitors, as well as CEOs.
Absolutely.
You know, we need – there's got to be room for everybody in this, or it's not going to be anything more than an elite.
No, there is room for
you
everybody.
Know, there is this criticism of the integral community, and I'm probably the evolutionary community, that it's just kind of a bunch of people who think they're better than everybody else and talk to each other, you know.
Well,
it seems to me that we are creating a new kind of culture, and that we need people who help create that culture on lots of different levels, and that anybody who meets any moment of challenge in their life with a full heart and sincerity and depth and courage can be an inspiration to anybody far further along on the path than they are.
Well, that's for
perhaps.
Sure. Well, you've just described a rare individual. you've described a rare man or woman, and such an individual in my book would be a spiritually quite an evolved soul.
But that,
I applaud
yeah.
individuals like that.
But we all have that opportunity in every moment. To just get off it and to really drop our story, drop our egoic motives, and courageously transcend and give ourselves to life in a whole new way. And it seems to me that that's available to everyone, and that there's a kind of higher developmental heroism that I hope to, you know, I aspire to, and that, you know, I think you're calling us to. But I want to somehow invite. I want this invitation to be to have doors that people can enter at every stage, and that can continually draw us forward into a deeper and deeper connectedness. This is one of the things that this leads to. Is, and maybe the one last question I should ask before we take questions from others, is this word enlightenment, which in some quarters is really being rejected. There are people who say, oh, this enlightenment word, you know, people have all kinds of idealistic ideas that everything's going to be Mother Goose beautiful, and they're going to be in some kind of nirvanic heaven as if they get enlightened, and they idealize enlightened people, and they always feel like they're short of something that they're not when they're not feeling enlightened, and it just splits them. It's a bad idea and a bad word, and we should reject it. And somebody once asked that question of Ken Wilber, and he responded, well, asking somebody if they're enlightened is a little bit like asking them if they're educated.
that you know, you can more enlightenment is a good thing, and you know, you may have been changed by some degree of awakening, but applying yourself to it more is valuable. At least that's what I took as the implications of that. But I think that you represent a kind of radical commitment that's fierce and that does have an absoluteness to it, and that the word enlightenment is somehow evoking that absoluteness. And I wonder how you feel about that word in the context of this whole idea of building a big tent that, has room for people who don't agree with you about everything. You know, that somehow we need a cultural alliance that's inclusive on a
I have lots of friends like you, Terry, that don't agree with me about everything, but we agree about but we agree about so many things that it creates a lot of room for a lot of wonderful, creative, and very positive friction.
Right.
I don't live in a world where I insist people agree with me about everything, but I want people to be honest and clear about what they do think, so we can all find out together what's actually true. But that being said, in relationship to the issue about enlightenment, well, I actually have come up with quite a rational with what I think is quite a rational model that really answers that question in what I feel is a satisfying way. And let me see what you think. But I do think that the word enlightenment is probably going to be outdated sooner rather than later. But the reason I like to use it is it represents spiritual attainment, and I think. Especially in the postmodern context, you know, establishing hierarchy in relationship to spiritual development and spiritual attainment is really, really very important. Because spiritually, you know, not all individuals are in the same place, and some people have gone farther than others. And I think that needs to be honored. You know, we need as you know, as was done, you know, in the traditions and in the traditional worldview, you know, spiritual attainment was honored because it was recognized in the traditional worldview that spirit is actually higher. And of course, because a lot of us are speaking about spirit within the context of a secular materialism, we even will hesitate to, even if we acknowledge that spirit exists, there's often a reticence to acknowledge that actually what we would agree that spirit is actually higher and maybe has greater value than anything else. So the reason I like the word enlightenment is because it insists on a hierarchy of value. In relationship to the whole notion of spiritual attainment, and it puts the whole question and issue of spiritual attainment on the table as something that maybe we need to, like, you know, to struggle with.
Mm-hmm,
you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because, you know, it's a little
like the critique of the postmodern helps to bring something into the conversation that needs to be there so that we don't end up with this green swamp in that case, or in this case with a kind of democratization of the field that doesn't allow depth to stand forth radiantly and powerfully and influentially and really change the conversation.
Yeah, because also when we have the capacity to recognize hierarchy in relationship to spirit, you know, then we begin to see spirit more clearly. We begin to see its contours and capacities in ways that otherwise we just simply wouldn't be able to see. But just to finish, in relationship to the whole notion of enlightenment, a simple model would be here and I think this is a way to make sense of it in a way that that can be, I think, very helpful for a lot of people to understand, you know, well, what is this enlightenment business anyway? Let's just say that 100% would represent the totality of who and what the individual person or personality or self actually is. So let's say that let's say you went to a spiritual bookstore and you met an individual there who was 5%. Because to go to a spiritual bookstore, you have to at least be 1 or 2% awakened to the spiritual impulse, and that's what brings you to the bookstore. But you're at a bookstore and then you run into an individual there and have a conversation with him or her, and that individual is actually 5% awakened to the spiritual impulse or evolutionary impulse. So they're more lit up than you are. They seem to be more in touch with whatever spirit is than you are, because they're more illumined. They have greater luminosity. They have greater inspiration, greater passion, greater clarity. And you say, wow, you know. And in light of their more awakenedness, you can feel the power of spirit. And you say, wow, you know, that's impressive. But then next week you go to the bookstore and you meet someone who's 10% awakened to spirit. So that would mean that 90% of the individual's personality would be identified with the fears and desires of the individual ego and of the culturally created self, whereas 10% of the individual personality now would be illumined by the light of the of our own spiritual nature, you know, the fearlessness,
mm-hmm.
the freedom of our own
mm-hmm.
spiritual nature. So there, so then you'd say the vehicle, which is the body and the mind, you know, is the vehicle for consciousness. We can say the vehicle then would still be under the dominion of the fears and desires of the individual and collective ego. And so then the next week you went to the bookstore again and you met someone who was 30% awakened to spirit. You say, well, wow. The power of spirit in an individual is so much stronger than the first person you met who was at 5% that you were convinced that the 30% person, you know, they were so they had so much charisma and so much clarity that you thought, well, they must, now I've actually met an enlightened person. But not really, because the individual is not enlightened yet, because it's all, there's still 70% of their vehicle is still under the dominion of the individual and collective ego, still under the power of it. So in this way of looking at it, we could say that until the identification, the self-identification of the individual has reached not less than 51% with spirit, unless my identity and your identity is now at least not less than 51% with spirit, you know, by any definition that we want to give it, that's not enough. That's not enough to fundamentally free the vehicle, because until the stronger half of who we are is spirit itself, I think that would be one very, very reasonable way to define what enlightenment was, because once the fears and desires of the personal ego and of the cultural culturally conditioned self have been displaced by the inherent freedom of spirit. We could say that's not enlightenment yet. There's some degree of awakening, of knowing of spirit, but the individual is not on the other side yet. And so when the individual would cross the 51% mark and they become firmly established at 51%, which means they're always at 51%, and they never go back to under 51%, you say, well, that would we could then agree, I say, whatever enlightenment is, we could say it would begin once the 51% threshold had been crossed, and then, of course, at that point on, there would be an aspiration to reach 60, you know, 70%.
Sure.
Whatever.
I love that, Andrew, because you know what's nice about it is that it allows for the gradual nature of human evolution.
Exactly.
And yet it and therefore somebody doesn't have to say, well, gosh, you know, I felt some lust or fear, or therefore, you know, as if they're trying to, you know, kind of absolutely purify every arising that might come up in their mind and feeling. Recognizing that that's not the point. It's how you choose. It's what shapes your behaviors and your decisions and your actual course of living and the way you treat other people and the way you enter into your life. That if those, you know, the more and more consistently you make those choices from a free place, you know,
yeah.
That's really one of the most important things that we develop. The ability to choose wisely on the basis of what we have understood, even when we don't feel it sometimes.
Absolutely, and I agree wholeheartedly. And just I would add to that that as this 51% threshold is crossed, what begins to happen is then the spontaneity, the unselfconscious spontaneity of spirit, you know, begins to overpower the self on more or less a continuous basis, so that the we begin to feel that there's something now that is animating and driving us that transcends our own will and our own mind, that spirit begins to work and act through us in spontaneous and miraculous ways because we have really given ourselves over to it, and now then it becomes the strongest part of who we are.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much, Andrew. Well, I feel like I want to just keep going, but I want to create an opportunity for others to join our conversation. So if you're listening on the web, you can go ahead now and type out a concise question in the Instant Teleseminar window starting any time now. But before we begin to answer any questions, I have a few announcements I'd like to make. I want to thank the presenters of the series, Evolving Wisdom and Integral Spiritual Practice. Beyond Awakening is also being made possible and is presented free of charge by the generosity of our many wonderful sponsors, including the International Society for the Study of Subtle Energy and Energy Medicine, ISEEM
welcomes researchers, healers, teachers, pioneers, anyone who is dedicated to living subtle energies as they relate to consciousness, healing, and human potential. ISIM is a world forum for promoting understanding, exploration, research, and application of the energies of consciousness. That's ISSSEEM.org. That's three S's and two E's, ISSSEEM.org. Also, our Sisters in Evolution at Feminine Power, where evolutionary women around the world are waking up to the extraordinary and committed passion of their feminine power. Find out more about the acclaimed work of Claire Zammit and Catherine Woodward Thomas and download a free 75-minute audio introduction at femininepower.com. It's titled The Keys to Feminine Power, Awakening the Three Power Bases of the New Co-Creative Feminine. You can look online at femininepower.com. And also by our friends at Tools for Wellness. For over 22 years, the people at Tools for Wellness have been leaders in offering excellent products for self-awareness, consciousness exploration, behavior modification, meditation, learning, memory, sleep, dreaming, sound therapy, stress reduction, relaxation, noise reduction, protection from electromagnetic fields, and a whole lot more. They're a reliable company and fair, and I know them well. I encourage you to check out their website at toolsforwellness.com. That's toolsforwellness.com. And finally, this coming Sunday, again at this same time, be sure to tune in to the next dialogue in this series. I'll be talking with Feminine Power co-creator Claire Zammit about a new women's spirituality, unleashing the power of the co-creative feminine. And that's for both men and women, not just women, this coming Sunday at 5 p.m. Pacific. And now, looking over at the questions that people have asked, we have a question from Joe in Tokyo, asking, I've heard you talk about collective awakening. I'm curious to know more about that. Is that just something for your students, or is this something others can participate in too?
Well, no, it's not just for my students. I mean, it's for anybody who's interested in the evolution of consciousness and evolution of culture. But it's become more apparent to me that the self that we are has been more conditioned by our shared cultural heritage and shared cultural values, the individual self that we are, than we imagine. So who we really are as individuals is really an expression and a manifest expression of culture itself. And so when you or I begin to share these higher values and higher aspirations, especially as it relates to the evolution of consciousness, you know, with other individuals, you know, when we want to aspire to take responsibility for where we're going, as spirit, when we awaken to spirit, and as spirit, we want to take responsibility for where we're going within the context of evolutionary becoming. What begins to happen is we begin to share or awaken to a higher, a deeper intersubjective world space, because as we both begin to awaken to what I call the evolutionary impulse, as we awaken to that impulse, it becomes apparent to us that we're on a moving train, that we're going somewhere, and the energy that is enabling us to move and to get moving is spirit itself, the nature of spirit is infinite. And so when human beings awaken to the unboundedness of the infinite nature of their own self, and in this case within the context of evolution, which is the fact that we're on a moving train that's going somewhere, we begin to share a different kind of intersubjective world space together. It's a world space that's going somewhere and that is imbued with the ecstatic freedom, which is the nature of spirit itself. So when individuals become interested in evolutionary becoming, there's a higher evolutionary we space that begins to emerge, or that does emerge, which has the contours of what I think what heaven actually is. We actually begin to experience what it's like to be in heaven right now. But this is evolutionary heaven, and evolutionary
that it's
heaven,
so profoundly blissful to be in that shared awareness field.
It's liberation itself.
Uh-huh.
It's liberation
itself.
But just to make the distinction here, that in evolutionary heaven, it happens in the context of being on a moving train, a moving plane. There's the sense of tangible vertical movement. We are moving. Whereas in the old traditional notions of heaven, that's a static realm where we experience peace, deep and profound and liberating peace, but we're not going anywhere. we're not going anywhere new.
That's great. Thank you. I appreciate that. I wish we could go into that topic for another hour and a half.
Well,
I want to take another question, and we have one that looks pretty interesting to me. Mike from Wanaka, New Zealand. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that right. Wanaka, New Zealand, says, "You keep mentioning courage. Can I, in quotes, have courage? Is there any real, quote, self-determination here? Why move in a direction unless absolutely moved? And in that case, is it actually courage or simply the only obvious direction to take? And how can one be moved to, quote, go all the way, unquote, without reinforcing the identity of the one who would do that?"
Well, as much as we speak about spirit, and as much as we speak about non-duality, we still are all always human beings, and all of the most enlightened saints and sages throughout history were all always still human beings. So no matter how enlightened we become, there's still always going to be an individual, a human being, a mortal self, a mortal soul, a mortal sheath. There's always going to be someone in there who's making choices, and all of the greatest liberated individuals throughout history have always spoke of the need to have courage, you know, especially when we aspire to take bold leaps forward. If we're endeavoring to be a spiritual hero, that takes a lot of human courage, because our psychological individuated ego and our will be intimidated by such a possibility. And of course, the part of ourself, the very big part of ourself that has been conditioned at least in the secular world, by the unenlightened values of our shared culture, will be extremely intimidated by a lot of the ideas that we've been sharing today. And so I think wholeheartedly, absolutely, unconditionally, yes, we as mortal human beings need lots and lots and lots of courage in order to make this bold leap. And of course, the more courageous that we're willing to be, the more that the fearless nature of spirit will begin to will awaken within us and enter into us and move through us. But even then, you know, we need courage to stand strong and not to withdraw even in the face of spirits revealing its true face to us, because even that can, for a lot of people, or for most people, can really be too much. You know, it's just too overwhelming. It's too much, and there can be a temptation to want to recoil, to want to return back to from whence we came. So we need lots and lots of courage. And no matter what anybody has told you, there's always an individual in there, and so that's the one who needs to have the courage.
Okay. Oh boy, we could go all kinds of places. Now, I do want to begin to open this up to folks who have called in on the telephone line. We have quite a few callers right now from, since it's been so international, I think I want to invite callers from Canada particularly. We seem to have a lot of Canadian callers. If anybody from Canada would like to ask a question, please press star 2, and that will raise your hand, star 2, on your telephone. And we can take any question or comment from Canada. Is there anybody from Canada? Okay, we've got somebody who's raised their hand. This may be a Skype caller. I don't see the name or anything. Please raise your hand again. I clicked the wrong place. So you who raised your hand, just do it again, and I will unmute your line. Thank you. Okay, what's your name? Hello. Hello? Well, we've got another question from Bend, Oregon. We don't have our Canadian, but we have Ken Sherman. Hello, Ken. Go ahead. You're unmuted. Well, Ken has disappeared, but our Canadian questioner has reappeared, so I'm going to invite you. All right. I think you may have called in on Skype. You are the person who raised
Hello?
Your hand originally. Hello.
Can you hear me?
I can. Yeah. Welcome. What's
okay.
your name?
I can't hear myself, but you seem to be able to hear me, so that's great. Thank you very much. My name is Ula Shine, phoning from West Coast Canada.
Okay, welcome. What's
Thank
the question,
you so much.
Ula?
Firstly, I think this is one of the best discussions in the subject matter that it's super important. I love the discussion and I still like it, but at the end when you were talking about the how we can sort of like witness or see the spiritual embodiment, I was getting a little bit slightly agitated by, I think, the presentation, because I think what I'd like to present and get comment about from you is in regards to the notion we may have of the spirit rather than, and, you know, a notion based on our ego-based notions or the traditional programmed notions rather than creatively evolving recognition and sensing of the spirit. So I'll stop there and ask for a comment in regards to what I'm asking.
Okay, Andrew, you want to respond?
I wasn't quite clear what the question was.
What I'm trying to say is, for example, I think there is a huge population that think that a somebody like Mother Teresa or Gandhi, and I'm not saying that they're not respectable, beautiful people, but I think there's a notion that people like them, celebritized, idolized people are better or even more spiritual people. And I would actually say that is very unhelpful, unevolving programmed notion of recognizing spirit. Alongside what I'm trying to say is that a movement, music, for example, punk, rock, rap, these are actually highly spiritual, part of the full spectrum of the spirit that I think is evolving. So if you still don't understand, I could go on, but do you understand?
Okay, I think I understand what you're saying, but I think it's basically quite simple. I think the truth in what you're saying, the truth is that spirit is one, and that's what its ultimate nature is. The ultimate nature of spirit is that it's one and not two. But that being said, different human beings, throughout history, have expressed and manifested different capacities to realize spirit. And of course, there's many different ways that spirit expresses itself, through music, as you were just saying, through art, through literature, through just about every human endeavor, spirit can express itself through cooking or through anything else. But nevertheless, that being said, it also is true that different individuals have different capacity, just like in any other form of human endeavor. You know, for example, you brought up music. I mean, there have been throughout history, you know, musical geniuses. You know, in Indian music, in classical music, in Western music, in jazz, there have been individuals who were geniuses, who had a greater capacity that was way above average, and therefore, when music entered into the world, you know, through their great gifts, they seemed to be more in touch with what music really is, and were able to convey it in a more profound way because of their great gifts and because of their great talents. And with spirit, it works the same way. Some individuals have a greater capacity and a greater commitment to spirit, and therefore have a deeper experience of what it is.
If you can hear me, I value and agree with what you've just said. However, I do disagree because I feel that, for example, it's the same thing. You know, many people automatically, without even thinking about it, would bow to the queen, for example, because of her status. And what I am trying to encourage, or even, you know, ask people to ask themselves, there is a beauty and importance in the namaste of everyone. And it's not because I just believe in, like, you know, like flat out non-brainer egalitarianism. It's because, and I also disagree with what you just said, there are I think it's very important to look at a person who doesn't seem to be so courageous, but look at the courageousness that they have done. Because
that's great, Ula. I'm glad we've gotten that point. I want to give a chance to for some other people to ask questions too. And want to respond to that, Andrew?
No, that's fine. I think I already did. Thank you.
Okay. Let's go a little closer to home for me, and anybody on the West Coast wants to raise your hand, please go right ahead. Let's see, I've got somebody from Escondido, California. Okay. Please go ahead. You're on the air. A person from Escondido, who has raised your hand, 760 area code. Hello. Well, we've unmuted somebody who's not there. You know, I'm going to take this moment to turn the conversation in a direction that I'm particularly interested in expanding on, which is there anything, Andrew, that we can do right now? Is there a way of participating in this call and the various different feelings and ideas that have been activated in this conversation that we've had right now, that would be a way for all of us who are participating to engage this collective field of intention and this evolutionary impulse? Is there, in a sense, an experiential process that you can invoke just by, in some sense, you've done that already by talking, but is there an injunction you'd like to express? I think that
well, would be. Well, I mean, I think I briefly mentioned it when we were speaking, but to me, the way we actually awaken and directly experience the movement that I was speaking about here is by cultivating the willingness to go all the way. Now, whatever that means. Now, in other words, if that's not as far as we've come yet, then what we can do in the present moment is to consider, even just within the privacy of our own thought process, you know, well, what does it really mean to go all the way? What could it mean? You know, just to begin, because what that really means is entertaining the notion of infinity, you know, entertaining the notion of an infinite release and an infinite embrace, not really being able to control what the outcome is actually going to be, and through entertaining, through considering, you know, in as serious and as passionately as we can, you know, that possibility, you know, of an infinite release and an infinite embrace, we will find access to depths of becoming that that maybe we just never even dreamed were possible. I mean, spirit is always ready and waiting to take us all the way. We just have to be ready to go along for the ride, and we just have to be ready.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful.
Okay.
You know, there's a question that's come in via the Instant Teleseminar window that kind of follows on to what you were just saying that I think is worth asking as a last question here as we get close to the end of our time. Someone who just identifies as D, an Ashkelon Israel, asks, what living laboratories are currently available to explore the evolutionary impulse and evolutionary consciousness?
The one I'm most familiar with is my own. This kind of work, especially looking at the nature of spirit within an evolutionary context. This is really new territory, and I'm not that. I mean, I know other people are looking into it, but in terms of this particular angle, the only one I know of at this particular point is my own group. That doesn't mean there's not lots of others that are, but I don't know about a lot of them.
Yeah, I think that I'm beginning to press into this a little bit in some of the work I'm doing with Craig Hamilton, but you've certainly been the progenitor of this experiment, and you take people into this in your long retreats. You just finished up
absolutely
a couple of 10-day retreats with people
absolutely.
In Colorado, and we'll be doing them again next year, right?
Absolutely, every year.
Yeah.
Every year.
Okay, well, thank you, everybody. We have gone over a little our usual time because we had a late start, and I want to thank you all for joining us. Thank you so much, Andrew. It's been really fun to get into this.
Thank you, Terry. It's been a pleasure and a privilege.
Yeah, well, thank you. Before I tell you all about what's coming up next week, a couple of reminders. Please be sure to join our Facebook group where you can discuss any of these topics. Just go to facebook.com, search for Beyond Awakening, or click on the link we sent you, or go to beyondawakeningseries.com/Facebook, and you'll get right there. You're invited to post your comments about today's dialogue and also suggestions or questions for Sunday's dialogue with the dynamic Claire Zammit, one of the founders of Evolving Wisdom and the co-creator of Feminine Power. I'll be speaking with her at 5 p.m. Pacific Time on A New Woman's Spirituality, Unleashing the Power of the Co-Creative Feminine. Something big is happening now with women's identity, power, purpose, contribution, and creative shared responsibility for our world in crisis. And Claire and I will be digging into what that is and how it's manifesting in the dynamic international community that has sprung up around her groundbreaking work and how women and men can be co-creators. Finally, if you or anyone you know might be interested in this series, please forward them one of the emails so they can join us too. And if you're just finding this on the internet, go to beyondawakeningseries.com and you can sign up to listen to any of the wonderful dialogues we've been having. If you want to learn more about my own work, please visit integralspiritualpractice.com. And finally, I want to thank some of the partners and sponsors who've made this all possible, especially Maestro Conference. Maestro Conference is a unique voice-based online collaboration platform that integrates the web and your telephone to support large-scale, real-time remote conferences, seminars, and interactive events. Using cutting-edge technology that empowers individual awareness and engagement, Maestro Conference offers a whole new way to engage people and create relationships, combining the ease of passive media with the engagement and excitement of live events. Visit them on the web at maestroconference.com. That's M-A-E-S-T-R-O, maestroconference.com. And also by our dear friends at Integral Enlightenment. Integral Enlightenment is an authentic, contemporary approach to spiritual practice designed to bring about a total transformation of our humanity. Founded by evolutionary pioneer Craig Hamilton, Integral Enlightenment seeks to revitalize the spiritual path to meet the evolutionary needs of humanity in the 21st century. Integral Enlightenment is a path for those of us who know deep down that spiritual life is about much more than our personal happiness or contentment. It's for those of us who feel compelled to transform ourselves in order to serve the greatest calling there is, the further evolution of life, humanity, and consciousness itself. To find out more about the work of Craig Hamilton and Integral Enlightenment, please visit integralenlightenment.com. And next Thursday, after Sunday will be the program I just announced. Next Thursday at this time, I'll be interviewing Gangaji on the evolution of spiritual practice in our time. And the following Sunday, Dr. Rick Hansen, bringing his deep engagement with contemplative neuroscience to discuss the awakening brain. So please mark your calendars and join us. Thank you so much for joining us now. And now, for the first time I've been able to, those of us who've survived the delays who are still here, I'd like to open up all our phone lines and let's just say goodbye. And I want to say thank you. So have we got the phone lines open, Brad? Goodbye, everybody.
Thank you. Bye.
Blessings.
Thank you.
Namaste. Namaste.
Okay. Hey, thank you very much. We can stop the recording.